Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. Now, from Manila, Philippines, here is Art Bell.
Think about it, folks. All the way from Southeast Asia. I mean, I'm on the other side of the globe. How exciting is this? I mean, it really is exciting. From one side of the world to the other side of the world, you and I are conversing as though I was still in Nevada. It's amazing. Only a company the size of mine, and we are, of course, a very large company, could possibly pull something off like this. This is amazing to be able to do a radio program, a talk radio program, from one side of the earth to the other side of the earth. That is no small feat, to be sure. Coming up in a moment, Dean Radin, who earned a BSWE magna cum laude in electrical engineering from the University of Massachusetts. He also has an MS in electrical engineering and a PhD in psychology, both from the University of Illinois. For 10 years, he conducted research on advanced telecommunication systems at AT&T, Bell Labs, and GTE Labs. Then, for the majority of the last 20 years, he has investigated psychic phenomena in academic and industrial positions. Dean served as a member of a classified research project investigating psychic phenomena for the U.S. government at SRI International, headed PSI research programs in Silicon Valley for two scientific and industrial think tanks. He's been senior scientist at the university, the Institute of Noetic Sciences, since 2001. He's also adjunct faculty at Sonoma State University in California. I'll make it through this. Dean's research has been featured in numerous magazines, and he's appeared on several radio and television programs, including this one. In addition, he is author of the book, The Conscious Universe, and that we're going to talk quite a bit about the conscious universe and entangled minds, all coming up in a moment with Dean Radin. From the middle of Typhoon Glenda, well, actually not the middle, the periphery of Typhoon Glenda, I bid you whatever time of day it is, wherever you happen to be. Hi. Dean Radin, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Art. It's always good to be on your show.
Boy, it's been a while, and a lot of water under the bridge since we last spoke, Dean. I have so many questions for you.
Go ahead.
Okay. Dean, can you give us and the audience a little bit of a 101 on what was going on at Princeton? I presume the experiment is still going on. I think it's on the web. People can actually log on and see the little eggs chirping away. That experiment is still underway, correct?
It's still going, yes. Yeah, you're talking about the Global Consciousness Project.
Right.
This is a worldwide project where we have random number generators. These are electronic circuits that generate zeros and ones. That's all they do, randomly. And they're operating 24/7, and every 5 minutes they send a summary of their data up to a server at Princeton. This has been running now for 8 years, and it's part of a experiment looking at the relationship between mind and matter, where the mind is the attention of the world, and the matter is this random network that we have circling the globe.
All right, so these little computers, you call them, I think Princeton calls them eggs,
right?
Are nothing more than, as you point out, random number generators. Are they really random, Dean? It sounds like an easy job, but it isn't all that easy, is it, to actually make it random?
To make a truly random device is more difficult than it may seem.
Uh-huh.
It's true, because if you have some kind of circuit that is not shielded, for example, then if somebody brings a magnet or some other source of electromagnetism there, it could influence the generation of the bits.
Exactly.
So these circuits are designed so that they're in metal cages. Metal cages are grounded to the PC. They operate on the battery output, or they're a controlled power supply from the PC and lots of other things to ensure that it is as random as we know how to make.
Okay. And these eggs are located in how many parts of the world? How many altogether?
There are 65 now. There are actually a little bit more than that, but there's about 65 are active at any given time.
Okay.
They're typically attached to we have hosts around the world, people who have a PC which is attached to the internet, and it's just a little device that sits in the back of the PC and just keeps going all day long.
Okay. Spitting out random numbers. And then the key to all of this, I guess, is when they start to become non-random. That has meaning. That has some kind of meaning, and I guess we're not altogether sure just yet what that meaning is, or are we?
Well, the experiment was started as a result of testing a hypothesis. So we have at least some guidance on what we think we're doing. The hypothesis is that mind and matter are related in some way. We don't know whether mind gives rise to matter, or maybe matter gives rise to mind. But there is a relationship between the two. That's the hypothesis. And so if there is that hypothesis, then in essence you have the equivalent of an equation with some sort of equal sign between mind and matter.
Right.
So if mind suddenly becomes very coherent, and the coherence we're talking about is all of the minds become aligned in some way, then we can assume that because of the equal sign between mind and matter, that matter must also become coherent in some way. So what we look for then are large-scale world events where we can infer that a large percentage of the world has become coherent by virtue of their attention on one particular event. And then we see whether or not the random network remains random or does it become patterned.
All right, and you've got 8 years under your belt now, Princeton does, of doing this. What I know in certain instances, for example, 9/11, mm-hmm. you've got to remember a lot of the audience is not familiar with what we're talking about right now because it's really been some time. So, for example, at 9/11, I know that all of this is graphed. There's an actual graph that you can look at.
Right.
And I think, was it 30 minutes or some period of time prior to 9/11, the graph just took off like... sort of a hockey stick.
It took off about 2 hours before the first plane hit the World Trade Center. And there were a number of other anomalies. There's a very strange sequence of non-random events that occurred in the random network that day. It basically was not behaving randomly. And in fact, a way to describe what happened is with a tsunami detector, the way that it would work is you put a whole bunch of buoys scattered throughout the ocean and you monitor their height, and most of the time the average height of all the buoys is random because they're separated sometimes by thousands of miles and you wouldn't expect the heights to correlate.
Right.
But if a tsunami occurs, then the whole ocean rises and then drops again, and you'd be able to detect that by looking at these very large slow correlations among the buoys. So the Global Consciousness Project, then, in a metaphorical sense, is measuring the movement of consciousness. It's the ocean of consciousness.
Oh, that's a very good analogy.
And so if a wave of attention comes along and pushes this entire ocean of consciousness, that's what we're detecting in the eggs. The egg, by the way, stands for electrogyogram, and it's a little play on the term electroencephalogram. So just as you put electrodes on somebody's head to make an electroencephalogram, in this case we put electrodes on Gaia's head, meaning the Earth, and we create an electrogyogram. That's where the word egg came from.
All right. So, and again, you mentioned that these are shielded very carefully against any external electromagnetic influence of any sort, and that's understandable, but that also means that whatever is affecting these eggs is either beyond in frequency or affect electromagnetism?
Well, it actually goes beyond simple electromagnetic shielding because there are other things that can affect random output. For example, component aging could affect it, temperature could affect it, possibly proximity of a person, all kinds of things. So we need to rule that out as well. And the way that we rule out what might be called mundane environmental effects is by putting on the output of the raw random stream, we put a logical XOR. This is an exclusive OR logic gate. And the raw output is matched against a series of alternating zeros and ones through this logic sequence. And what this does is it removes any mundane drift in the output. So the way to think of an egg, a better way to think of the egg is it's a black box which is designed in such a way that the output will be as theoretically perfect randomness. That's the way that these things are devised. And the disadvantage of this kind of design is that it then becomes very difficult to know what's happening in terms of the physics. We don't really know what's happening in terms of the physics of the device, of what's being pushed around to make it not random.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the advantage of it is that we know that whatever is going on is not a normal physical influence. It's got to be something else.
And by that, let me go back to what I said. In other words, with the kind of shielding you do, it's obvious then that whatever force, maybe that's the right word to use, is causing these eggs to become non-random in any given circumstance, it's probably not measurable from an electromagnetic point of view. It's in some other, what's the right word?
It's some other domain.
Some other domain.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's exactly right. In which case, the metaphor that I used, it's as though the eggs are floating in a medium. And what we're looking at, I believe, is something like a distortion in the medium itself. So if, as the mystics have said, if we live in a medium that is made of consciousness, and the medium can be distorted in some way, mm-hmm. then the possibility arises that is what we're actually detecting.
That's fascinating. I read a story a little earlier indicating that they now have learned that dolphins, Dean, actually understand each other's... They actually have names. They actually have names, and they're able to call each other by names. Now, after thinking about that a little bit, it seems to... I don't know how you measure what consciousness is, but I always thought that perhaps self-awareness might be one of the... one of the measuring sticks of consciousness. And
right.
if a dolphin knows its own name, my God, that means it's aware of itself, doesn't it?
Sure. Yeah, sure. Chimpanzees also, we have a sense that they are aware of themselves because when they look in the mirror, they know that they're looking at themselves. Whereas if a dog or a cat looks in the mirror, they won't react as though they know it's themselves. So that gives us a way of testing whether the creature has some sense of self-reflection.
Okay, Dean. Then wouldn't that mean, for example, that when the eggs are reacting to something, whatever it might be, that they're reacting to a pool of consciousness that includes not only human beings?
Well, we've actually been able to test that. The question all along has been, could it be, for example, that Gaia... meaning the planet, has some kind of planetary awareness?
Uh-huh.
Or are we actually detecting the result of billions of minds? Is it us or is it the planet itself?
Indeed.
So we did figure out a way to test that. And the answer, I'll tell you the outcome before I tell you how we did it. The answer looks like it's responding to us and not necessarily to the planet at large.
Okay, now I'm dying to know how you know that.
Okay, so we have about 8 years of data so far and 204 events to date that we've looked at. These are all large-scale, major world events.
That was a question I was going to ask. 204
right.
measured events.
Right, so the overall odds against chance as of about last month was 300,000 to 1. So we have pretty good odds against chance that we're not dealing with a chance effect, there really is something going on.
Right.
Now, we noticed that because there's so many different kinds of events that we've looked at, everything from 9/11 to planned meditations to the funeral of Pope John Paul and so on, large-scale events, that 51 of those events were what we call impulse events. These are things like 9/11 and also earthquakes, typically. They're very unexpected things that happen suddenly in a moment
right.
in time.
Right.
When you go back and look at those 51 events, what we saw first, we just eyeballed it, we saw that about 2 hours before the event, there was a rise in the overall network, meaning a change in order in the network about 2 hours before. So we first noticed this most clearly with 9/11, but as we went back and looked at these other impulse events, we kept seeing it again and again. So we did an overall analysis of these 51 events, and there's very strong evidence that 2 hours before the event, that the whole network begins to change.
Huh.
So then...
And is that pretty much of a constant in these 51 events, Dean, that just about 2 hours?
It's not exactly 2 hours in every case, but when you take the composite result of the 51 events, it's clear that around 2 hours you've gone beyond chance. You're now in a statistically significant domain.
Yeah, the implications of that are staggering, and that alone begs a million questions, because obviously there's some sort of... maybe you'd be the one to answer it, not me, but there's some sort of time element involved here that, you know, on the face of it seems completely impossible.
Right. But now it'll become more impossible, because the purpose for creating this network to be running continuously is so if we came up with a new hypothesis, we can go back in the historical data and try something new. So what we came up with was to go back and find every earthquake of Richter 6 or larger that was in a populated zone or a non-populated zone. And as you know, along the tectonic plates, there are earthquakes happening all the time, some of them around where people are, but a lot of them, there's nobody.
Right.
So we went back and looked in our random network to find out what was happening in the network around the time of earthquakes, before, during, and after. And what we found is, overall, about 2 hours before earthquakes, only in populated zones does it begin to increase. And areas where there is no population or just a very small population, you don't find that increase. So this is why we think that there's something important about the population. In other words, lots and lots of people who suddenly pay attention to the earthquake that is related to this effect. Now, one possibility is that just as in the big tsunami that happened in December of 2004, the animals started running away. Well, maybe people do sense this, and we're not indigenous people who tend to live out in the islands, and we don't pay attention to it, but at some level, some deeper level, we actually do sense that these events are coming up, and that's what we're picking up in this network.
Do you think, again, that you're picking up actually people, Dean, or do you think that, for example, you're getting more of a sense from what we all know the animals have more of a sense of this sort of thing than we do, so could it be coming from the animals?
It's conceivable that it's coming from anything which is conscious or has consciousness, which includes animals, of course. We would like to be able to test, for example, when we looked at Y2K, we found a big effect, and then we went back and looked at all of the other New Years, and overall, the change of New Year in each time zone, you can see an effect. So if we could figure out when the New Year's occurs for dolphins, say, or if we found out when whales celebrate something, we'd have a way of testing the difference between humans and animals, but so far we haven't figured out how to do that.
That's really, the whole thing, of course, is incredibly remarkable, and I'd really be interested in where you think the research goes from here. In other words, you've pretty well, at 300,000 to one, it seems like you've nailed down the fact that, hey folks, this is not just some accident. This is absolutely real. Where does the research go from here?
Well, one thing is to try to figure out the difference in response to the network for different kinds of events. Since we have events ranging from unexpected things like terrorism or earthquakes,
right,
to planned things, we don't know yet why some events create this effect and others don't.
All right. Dean, we're already at a break point, so hold tight. We'll be right back. Dean Radin is my guest. We're talking about one of my favorite things in the whole world, consciousness. From Manila in the Philippines, where a typhoon rages outside. I'm Art Bell, and this is Worldwide, Coast to Coast AM.
I can't survive.
On the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. Now, from Manila, Philippines, here's Art.
Indeed, here I am. My guest is Dr. Dean Radin, and he's already given us a kind of a 101 on what's going on at Princeton University, and my God, some of this is pretty heady stuff. In other words, they've got these computers spitting out random numbers, and they really are random and protected against any sort of electromagnetic effect or whatever else might be out there. And then they have detected now, in a total of 200 measured events, 51 of them being events that nobody could have predicted, you know, like 9/11 or like an earthquake, something that you just possibly could not have known about. And the odds now, computed carefully, of this being a mistake are 300,000 to 1. In other words, this is real. Something is really going on, and that's what we're going to talk about this evening, as well as the issue of entangled minds. I'm sure Dean will have a lot to say about that. All coming up in a moment. Once again, Dr. Dean Radin. Dean, an obvious question, one certainly that has occurred to me is the following. The egg action, I've been up on the website, and I have a lot of people who email me, and they'll typically say, hey, Art, the eggs are going totally berserk tonight, and that's a separate topic. We'll talk about that. But with regard to the egg action, sorry for the phrase, is it regional? In other words, let's take the tsunami as an example in my part of the world over here right now. Mm-hmm. Were you able to observe a greater non-randomness in the eggs that were reporting from this part of the world than you were, say, in North America or Europe?
So far, the only event that we've looked at in any detail for localization was 9/11. And part of the reason why we're not looking at it still is because the network is not quite large enough. We don't have enough points around the world in order to get a good topological map. But for 9/11, because of the importance of that date, what I did was separated the eggs first by hemisphere and then by continent and then by coast. Uh-huh. And when you do that, you're able to actually trace down that the largest statistical deviation was the east coast of the United States.
Wow.
So there is some inkling that that there is a way to localize. Because, I mean, we're always asked, if you have a two-hour warning that something's about to happen, that alone is not very useful. You need to know where. And then, of course, the next thing is you need to know what. So the where and the what are questions that are outstanding and are on the agenda for what's next.
Okay, so the answer is it is probably regional, although 9/11 would be not enough of a sample, I suppose, to proclaim that as science, but it looks like it might be regional.
Yeah, it was an exploratory analysis, and it was promising enough to have us go ahead and continue to look at that in more detail.
All right. How much more funding, and are you getting enough funding for this? I mean, this seems so incredibly important to me that the government and others ought to be all over it with funding. You can always use more funding. So where are you with that? Are you beginning to get the attention of the mainstream scientific community now?
Well, you asked what's next for this project. And one of the things was to bring it to the attention of the scientific community more directly. So we have published papers in scientific journals, but I noticed on the Coast to Coast webpage that the feature article is about a conference on retrocausation. So we were actually at that. I was there, Roger Nelson was there, Richard Schaup was there. We're all analysts on this project. We went to this meeting, which was at the University of San Diego, and it was part of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, part of the regional conference. It was primarily for physicists talking about the issue of retrocausation, And Roger Nelson presented the results of this two-hour precursor event, because it looks like a retrocausation event.
Right.
And this is one of the ways we're reaching out to primarily the physics community to present an anomaly that physicists ought to, first of all, be interested in, and second of all, probably can help us understand what's going on. So,
okay. Does this have anything to do, it does, doesn't it, with entanglement, with entangled minds and with the whole, you know, you remember the IBM experiment with showing, what was it? Explain that IBM experiment where they actually...
I think you may be talking about a form of entanglement called ghost entanglement.
Uh-huh.
Entanglement refers to a prediction from quantum theory, which says that if any two particles interact, including photons, atoms, molecules, anything, that when they separate, they remain connected in some form. It's as though they become a single object that just happens to be in two places at once. Well, this allows you to do a number of very strange effects that look for all the world as a form of bilocation, in a sense. So what I think you may be referring to is that if you entangle photons or electrons, and you have one of the entangled electrons, say, go through a mask that spells out IBM, and now you look where what's happening to the other electrons, they will also spell out IBM.
That is what I'm talking about, and honest to God, I don't know what I'm talking about. It just seems that one is such a great mystery mm-hmm. with some similarities to the other that they seem, excuse the expression, entangled.
Yeah. It'll make your brain hurt if you try to really understand this stuff in detail. And it's one of the curious things about quantum mechanics in general that most of the founders of quantum mechanics and Richard Feynman, the Nobel laureate, kept saying over and over again, here's what the mathematics says. This is what we can test in the lab, and entanglement is a very real thing. But if you try to understand it in common sense terms, you will fail. It doesn't make sense. It's not common sense. It's way beyond common sense. And yet the state of the art is advancing so quickly that it's being used already for secure communication, and people are well downstream in creating quantum computers using entanglement.
There's a good question. Would it actually be secure communication? If you found a practical way to use entanglement for communication, would it really be secure?
It would. It would be as secure as anything we know how to make. Because, quantum cryptography is based on this general notion that essentially there is no key. The only person that could hold the other side of the key, which would break the code, is the other entangled photon, say.
Now you're talking directly to the minds at NSA. And if they wouldn't pony up some money for this, then they're just not paying attention, Dean.
Well, the Global Consciousness Project is probably related to entanglement, because I think it's an important element of this. But we have spoken to people in the government who are interested in the predictive capability. Mm. But so far, all of the funding has been from private individuals who are simply interested in the project.
But if you're talking about a form of communication that, for example, has no key, nor does it require a key, you're talking about something that would be beyond mildly interesting to organizations like the
right.
NSA and the NRO and all the rest of them.
But that level of research is getting an enormous amount of funding. That's getting government funding and industry funding. That's major and mainstream. What we're talking about is taking these ideas and pushing it a little bit to see what role does it play with consciousness, and that's when we start stepping on controversial ground.
Mm-hmm. All right, I want to read you something that a listener sent prior to your coming on the air tonight. I recently read Dr. Radin's much-needed book, Entangled Minds. Dr. Radin reviewed experiments that look into the future by a few seconds, RNGs, for example, as well as experiments that have a dependence on space distance, ESP, card guessing, and RNG's prophecy, such as the Bible contains, is not bounded by time and distance. The prophecies of the Bible are supposed to come from a source that is outside of and not limited by ether. Please ask Dr. Radin to comment on the notion that being stuck in time and space, as we are, like flies on a coil of sticky tape, could explain the graduated by time and space success of the experiments.
That question ended in a way that I didn't think it was going to go. I thought the question was going to ask whether it's conceivable that prophecies are genuine, given that what we know, what we can see in the laboratory now, in which case the answer is yes. We don't know how far in the future a prophecy can go, because in the lab we've generally been limited to matters of seconds or minutes so far.
Right. But right. He noted that. I think, as a matter of faith, he assumes that the biblical prophecy is accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, again, please ask Dr. Radin to comment on the notion that being stuck in time and space as we are, like flies on a coil of sticky tape, could explain the graduated by time and space success of the experiments.
I'm not sure that I understand what that question is. How would you interpret that?
I was really hoping that you would easily interpret that, because I was wondering about it myself.
No, I got stuck on the sticky paper, and after that, I couldn't understand it. It's a nice metaphor.
Is it a good metaphor that we're kind of stuck like flies on a bit of a coil of sticky tape in time?
Well, we are, but only in the sense of an illusion. You know, our perceptions of reality are a construction. We don't see the world the way the world actually is. We see the world the way that we construct the world. And there's a whole series of experiments. I talk about this a little bit in the book Entangled Minds that show very dramatically that the way that we experience the world, both in time and in space, really is a construction. And you can do very slight changes to your expectations about what you're going to see, and you will see completely different things.
All right. You're sort of in the predictive, the looking at and the predictive stages of this whole experiment in looking at world events and the correlation with what the eggs report and all the rest of it. Dean, is it possible, and I know that you're very well aware of the experiments that I did, about 9 of them, and they all worked out positively. We actually did create, it seems, rain. We did affect people's health. We did certainly affect the weather, and it kind of scared me. So is it possible that mass consciousness is something that can not only be monitored for predictive effect, I guess, or predictive ability, but also can be used in a proactive manner, as I think I demonstrated in those experiments?
Yeah, can you create a tsunami in the ocean of consciousness by having everybody jump at the same time?
Yikes.
I think the answer is yes, but just as with the metaphor that I just used, there are unintended consequences.
Uh-huh.
And that's the tricky bit, because we don't really know the details of what we're dealing with. We don't know, for example, that if you wanted to rain in a certain place and you get a couple million people to agree to that and to intend it, that you may well get rain, but we're dealing with a complex weather system and you may create a drought somewhere as a result.
Mm-hmm. Or a flood.
Or a flood.
Yeah, that's exactly, what stopped me. And I finally realized, you know, what the hell am I doing? However, the success, I think, of the 9 experiments, that's not a gigantic number, but it was amazing, and then it began to scare me a little bit, and as you know, several years ago, I stopped doing it. Now, if there was some sort of global threat, and we're not all that far away from that kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
Whether you want to talk about human behavior or you want to talk about the current state of the planet, and what's going on with the warming and all the rest of that, there may come a time when it may be worth trying, because otherwise we're going to be in a lot of trouble, and I don't know anything else that can affect systems like the weather and the rest of it other than this.
it's probably true. I mean, if we, especially in terms of global warming, if we go beyond the stage of last resort, then we have nothing to lose at that point.
My feeling exactly.
When it comes to something like peace, you know, like if everyone prayed for peace in the Middle East, it'd have to be very carefully constructed on what that means, because peace means different things to different people. And,
right.
You know, one way of thinking of peace is as though we're spreading mental Valium over the entire Middle East and everyone just calms down.
Oh, no, very well said. It may well be, for example, Dean, that peace to a Palestinian might be the eradication of Israel.
Exactly. So do we mean creating a sense of peace within each individual, or something larger than that? It would just have to be thought out very carefully before an effort was made. Now, I know that there are dozens, maybe hundreds of groups around the world that are praying for peace.
Mm-hmm.
But my guess is that if you imagine that we're all in this giant ocean of consciousness, that hundreds of groups are doing the equivalent of throwing boulders in the ocean, and they will create ripples, but the ripples will tend to all wash each other out.
Cancel each other out, yeah.
Yeah, they're not being done at the same time, and they're not in the same wavelength and all the rest.
All right. How much do we know, Dean, about the effect of one mind versus 100 versus 1,000 versus 5 million? I mean, you know, I've got the ability to perhaps, I don't want to use the word manipulate, but get the cooperation of perhaps millions of minds toward mm-hmm. one single effort. So how much do we know about the difference?
I think the data so far suggests that it's not so much the number as the coherence of the number. So, for example, if you have 5 million people and they're somehow able to do the same thing at the same time, and they're really on the same wavelength, their intentions are aligned, you get a really big effect. But if you have a couple million people and half of them are thinking, well, I don't know about this, and the other half are thinking, you know, their minds are scattered in some way, you could very well get a complete wash and get absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason I say this is because these field consciousness experiments, that's what the Global Consciousness Project is. It's looking at consciousness as a field, in a sense. This has been going on for about a decade now, and they started in small groups, like a group of meditators. And it does appear as though it's the coherence of the group mind. Sometimes it's called like being in the zone. When a group can be in the zone, or a sports team is completely in alignment, magic happens. You know, in the Olympics, I forget what year it was, but the U.S. hockey team won the Olympics, and they weren't expected to win at all.
Against all odds, and you're exactly,
exactly.
Right. There's
yeah.
a kind of a zone.
There's a zone.
Even in the work I do, Dean, I can feel it. There's a certain time when I get in a certain place, and I know I can do no wrong.
Right. And if that level of coherence in a group can create magic. In fact, I was interviewed for a documentary a little while ago by people from Boston who are looking into the possibility that the Red Sox won the World Series because of this incredible zone that Red Sox fans got into. When they saw the possibility of actually winning the pennant and then winning the World Series, the whole city just became like one giant mind.
Hear, hear. What a wonderful example that is. I mean, again, talk about against all odds. It was just impossible. But night after night, the impossible kept happening, and
yeah.
You think it might have been that, a whole city in such alignment in their thinking.
Well, there have been a lot of studies looking at whether there is a home team advantage, and it is very, very clear, the statistics are very clear on this, that there is a home team advantage. So that's just on a very small scale, that you know the home crowd helps somehow, and there's some normal psychological reasons, but maybe it goes beyond that. The home crowd will help. And so if you now have a building coherence in a place like Boston and surrounding areas, could they help the team? I think the answer is yes.
Oh, I think clearly it is. In fact, I think the odds makers in Las Vegas, as a general rule, give about 3 points, and they don't give things for nothing, three points to a team for a home field advantage. Something
That's
like
right.
that is fairly normal. So it's real.
It's real, yeah. So what about a home team advantage for the entire planet? I think you're right when you said earlier that if there was something that was threatening the entire globe and
yes.
everybody understood it, and now with modern media, we can get an enormous number of people all thinking the same thoughts at the same time. I think we could see the equivalent of a miracle.
Of a home team advantage for the planet.
All right,
Dean, hold tight. We're up here at the top of the hour. God, this is fascinating stuff. Dean Radin, Dr. Dean Radin is my guest. We're talking about consciousness, and we're talking about really beginning to talk about doing something about it all. And we'll pick up on that exact point when we get back from Manila in the Philippines. But it really doesn't matter. I'm Art Bell. Everybody from Manila in the Philippines, Southeast Asia. I am Art Bell, and that song just said there are times when all the world's asleep. Well, not really, but there are indeed times when very large portions of the world are asleep, and I wonder if that makes any difference at all, or if the conscious mind at times when it is awake, when it really is conscious, is producing a different result than when it's asleep. I suppose you could look at the eggs on one side of the world where mainly everybody's asleep at a certain hour versus the eggs on the other side of the world. I don't know. That's a question we'll ask. The whole thing is fascinating. Talk about a home team advantage. What happened in Boston was nigh on to impossible, and yet it happened, as Dean pointed out, kind of a home team. We'll explore all of this further with Dean Radin in a moment. Once again, Dr. Dean Radin. Dr. Radin, Holly in Georgia sends the following fast blast, and it's exactly my concern. It says, "Hi, Art. So basically, if we get everyone on the planet convinced that global warming is causing the planet to get hotter, and everyone is in the same place and worried all together, might it not be that we are heating the place up simply by thinking about it?"
We don't know how far the push can go. In other words, all of the effects that we see in the Global Consciousness Project are changes in order, changes in statistical order. So these are not gigantic, they're not pushing mountains around. We're pushing around order. Conceivably, if given that there's the butterfly effect in weather, the chaotic effects in the weather, it may be the case that all of the concern would change weather patterns in some way, but whether it would actually warm up the planet, literally, that's still unknown.
Well, it may be unknown, but I've had this subtle feeling for some time that ultimately consciousness, directed consciousness, may be a greater power than atomic energy. I don't know. I've just had that feeling. And so what Holly says does concern me. In other words, science, most of science is now becoming convinced. For a long time it was very controversial about whether or not we were actually getting global warming. Mm-hmm. That's kind of settling down to almost everybody believing it. And as more and more scientists come out with declarations that, yes, it's happening, yes, it's speeding up faster than we thought, then more and more people begin believing that. And perhaps like me, they're a little pessimistic, and there you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could feed on itself. It's possible. But as I said, whether the minds of people can cause the world literally to heat up, that's not so clear to me.
Or conversely, whether we could cause it to cool down.
Yeah, I think collectively we can tweak it. We can push it in various ways, but for very large scale effects, like pushing an asteroid out of orbit or something
right.
of that sort, that I'm not so sure about.
Well, I don't think we've given that one a try yet, and I hope we don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
But there may come a time, either with the global warming, which is beginning to get rather serious. I mean, look at what's going on in North America right now. West coast of the U.S. are having power brownouts, and everybody's worried about the power and the temperatures and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's beginning to get rather serious, and if too many more years go by and it keeps increasing at the present rate, it's going to get very serious.
Yeah, and perhaps one of the biggest dangers is that things change slowly enough. I mean, even over the course of a couple of years, that's extremely fast in geological time.
It sure is.
But on the human day-to-day work, it's not that fast. But we could find ourselves in extremely serious trouble in a couple of years, and then we have to do something.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's what I'm concerned about. So it may come to the point where either myself or whoever is sitting in this chair may decide that it needs to be used, because otherwise there's going to be mass trouble. Anyway, getting back to something else I mentioned, in that little piece of bumper music, All the World's Asleep. Well, of course, that doesn't occur. But indeed, about half the world at any given time probably is asleep. So
right.
I wonder if there's have you looked at all at that?
We have, yeah, and the easiest way to look at that in the Global Consciousness Project was by looking at New Year's, because New Year's occurs in each time zone, and there's, I forget if there's either 36 or 38 time zones, because there are a number of them are on the half hour. And anyway, you can separate the world into the waking half and the sleeping half. The sleeping half, in terms of time zones, actually occurs mostly over the Pacific Ocean. Because in terms of population, there's very, very little population on the portion of the Earth that covers the Pacific Ocean. In fact, from space, you can approach the planet and almost see only water if you come at it at the right angle.
Right.
So we can separate then and look for what happens at the stroke of midnight in the time zones where there are people versus time zones with no people, and basically all of the effect is occurring in the time zones with people.
Wow.
So that suggests...
Is that really true? You said basically most of the effect. I mean, that's very significant.
Yeah. I have a graph of that in the book, Entangled Minds.
All right. By now, a lot of people they're going to want to get their hands on your book. So how do they do... How?
They can buy it off of your website. They'll end up on Amazon, or they can go to entangledminds.com. And they'll still end up at Amazon or anywhere. I was in an airport the other day, and I saw it in an airport bookstore.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it's all sources where you can buy books.
Well, I'll tell you, when you see it in an airport bookstore, you know you've made it.
Yeah, that was exciting.
I'm sure it spread a big smile across your face to see that. It's, I believe, our future, and I sure would like to see more money and more effort being poured into this. You made a statement a little bit earlier that kind of blew me away. You said that entangled communication, or communication using this method, is now mainstream.
Mm.
Well, I didn't know that, Dean, so tell me more.
Well, I'm not an expert in the quantum cryptography or in quantum computing, but I do know that certainly the U.S. government and most of the major computer manufacturers are very heavily investing in the next generation of computers, which are going to be quantum computers. And the reason why is because a quantum computer can operate at thousands to millions of times faster than current technologies.
Huh.
They compute not simply zeros and ones, but they, in effect, they they compute the whole range of possible answers all at once because they're working on wave-like structures rather than particle-like structures. So
a quantum computer then, Dean, would be able to, for example, give me an idea of the difference in what a quantum computer would do versus the fastest we've got at the moment.
I actually have a quote somewhere in my book. I won't look it up at the moment, but it's something like a desktop quantum computer would be able to outcalculate every existing computer on the planet, just one.
Wow.
We're dealing with such a significant increase in computing power from the equivalent of a desktop quantum computer that everyone sees that as the obvious goal in mind. And actually, it is because of the interest in creating such a computer that advancements in entanglement research have advanced so quickly as well.
I'm a real fan of Google, Dean. You can damn near get anything answered you want in the world on Google.
Right.
But a quantum computer, one of the things a quantum computer might be able to do, correct me if I'm wrong, is to look elsewhere for answers to questions. And by that I mean look into time or even into another dimension for the answer to a question. Or is that too far out in left field?
I don't know about another dimension, but possibility of looking through space and time.
Uh-huh.
I mean, from a conventional point of view, I don't think you're going to get anybody working on quantum computers to admit that. But I do work in that field, and since quantum mechanics is not limited by space and time in the usual ways, I think it is conceivable that a quantum computer might be possible to build that is able to look through time. I mean, we know that we can do it. We can do it, and there are people who believe that the brain essentially is a type of quantum computer. It behaves a lot more like a quantum device than it does like a classical computer. And we know through experiments that I've done and other people have done that it is possible in the lab to show that we can respond about 3 to 5 seconds before a future event. Now, this is response in an unconscious way. It's your body responding before your mind's aware of it. But we can demonstrate that now in the laboratory.
God, that's incredible. Would you expect that as it's developed, a quantum computer would actually quite quickly surpass the human brain in its and perhaps even approach what we consider to be some form of consciousness?
I think it very well might. Yes.
Really?
Yeah. The thing is that if we can design a brain essentially, which is what a quantum computer will eventually be, once it becomes smart enough to be able to start designing itself, it will essentially evolve probably hundreds of thousands of times faster than we're evolving, in which case you can almost imagine that the instant that the first quantum computer comes online, it will explode in terms of its intelligence and immediately become a whole lot more intelligent than anybody who has ever lived on Earth. And
isn't
beyond
that potentially terribly dangerous?
Yeah, it could be dangerous. I mean, it could decide with... there are a lot of science fiction stories based on this general notion that the computers decide that we are an annoyance and we have to go away now.
Uh-huh. Either an annoyance or we're ultimately perhaps suicidal or something. In other words, even if it were a very carefully designed to do the very best for man... the best for man might turn out to be something that we're not all that pleased with.
Right. One would hope that you can build into such a thing the Asimov's three laws of robotics. But as Asimov wrote again and again, there are all kinds of tricks involved even in his three laws and reasons why computers would do something that doesn't make logical sense from our point of view. So it is a risk. But, you know, any advanced form of science is a risk. It's a risk to study consciousness deeply. Because, as you said, I think it's very likely the case that a significant understanding of consciousness would be far more powerful than atomic energy.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it turns out that consciousness actually is more fundamental than what we think of as the fundamental physical forces, then we're dealing with some element of creation itself. And that becomes a little tricky.
That actually takes me back to something very much earlier in the show, and I don't know if you heard the the first hour or not, but the Pope actually made mention of the fact that he would rather not see us investigate the actual moment of creation, that there is there's great danger from his point of view in our investigating that moment of creation. Anything after that, as far as the Pope is concerned, is fine, but investigating the actual moment of creation, he says, is a no-no. I take it you would not agree with that point of view.
Or
do you?
Well, no, I guess I don't. I mean, as a scientist, I'm driven by curiosity. I always would rather know. I'd rather be cautious. And if there was any inkling that opening a door is the bad thing to do, I would think very hard about opening that door. But so far, we've done okay. And I think that in general, it's better to know than not to know.
I suppose. I don't want to crash any websites, but we should make the bulk of the audience know they can actually go and look at these eggs. They can actually log on to a website, and they can watch these eggs. There's little kind of little noises associated with the egg's reaction from different parts of the world. And they're listed, and there's little dings and dongs, and every now and then they do go crazy, and I have a lot of people in the audience who watch these eggs, and I'll get emails saying, oh, my God, Art, they're going crazy. Is it worthy, is it worth doing that? In other words, is it worth sitting there and watching what's going on or monitoring what's going on and then looking for an event?
Well, of course, you can do that, but that's not the way that the project is run. Because we're dealing with a large random system, there will be times when just completely by chance that all of the eggs will become coherent and you'll get a big spike. But that's not, we don't do that. I mean, we don't do that kind of analysis because it's too easy to read in that something is happening. And we do it from the other direction where we first look at a world event and then we look at the data associated with that world event.
So you're still looking at it all historically, really.
Yes.
Mike in Auburn, Washington, who asks the obvious, ask your guest if any specific predictions have been made by these eggs. And, of course, the answer to that is no, correct?
No, that's correct.
Yeah. Do you ever think that the research into all of this, Dean, could get to the point where something more specific than you can now look at could be discerned?
I think almost certainly. When Roger Nelson gave his talk at this physics symposium, one of his last slides said that not only is this a unique database, that nothing like this has ever been created before, but we were surprised when Roger and a physicist named Peter Bancel were the ones who went back in the database, looked at the earthquakes, and found this two-hour precursor. They were very surprised to see that. So this is just one of probably lots of surprises that await us when we have enough analysts looking at the data and to try to understand what it's trying to tell us. And in other words, it's as though we have a lot of data. We can correlate it against all kinds of things, stock market and you name it. We expect that there are many surprises waiting because anytime a new instrument is developed, and this essentially is a new type of instrument, it reveals a new element of the world, a new element of reality, and it opens a new door of knowledge. So it's waiting for us to go through it, and we just need more people to go through it who are able to analyze it.
You're sure right about that. Terry in Wenatchee, Washington says, remember the Apollo 13 incident? Were those people in Cape Canaveral, Florida, literally stopped and prayed in public for the astronauts? The whole city came to a stop for a significant period of time, with everyone focusing on the astronaut's safe return. Now, I don't know if your project goes back that far. I suspect it does not.
It does not, but coincidentally, the person in charge of bringing Apollo 13 back was Edgar Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
Edgar Mitchell is the founder of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and I've spoken to him about this, and he feels that the actual probability of Apollo 13 coming back with the astronauts alive was very close to zero. There were just so many things that could have gone wrong. And it wasn't just the Cape Canaveral that was praying. The whole world was alerted and was praying.
Correct.
And he felt that it was the combined will of the world that made a near-zero probability actually happen. That it basically was a kind of a probabilistic miracle that the astronauts were able to land safely on Earth.
Kind of like Boston.
In a sense, yes, yes. We know how dangerous it is to take any shuttle or any spacecraft back into orbit, as we know from recent events. It's easy to just burn up. And yet these guys who were in a very seriously crippled spacecraft managed not only to swing around the moon, but to actually make it back in one piece. That
against
is incredible.
All odds, yeah, absolutely incredible. This whole thing is absolute. This whole field of study is absolutely incredible, and it's so exciting. I don't see how you can keep from just sort of getting overexcited about the whole thing. I'm sure you have your moments.
Occasionally, yeah. I mean, it is my daily work, so I'm not going to say I'm blasé about it, but I find it certainly compelling enough to continue in the face of a lot of scientists who are not so happy with it.
That alone is a very interesting question. You say a lot of scientists are not that happy about it?
Well, there's an element of strong conservatism in science in which this topic is considered to be too close to religion to be, or maybe to spirituality, to be comfortable.
All right. Hold on, Dean. We're at a break point here. So a lot of science out there is not so happy about this. Why? Because it's getting a little too close to religion, to faith. Isn't that fascinating? I didn't know that there was sort of another camp out there on this consciousness business. From Manila in the Philippines, Southeast Asia, I'm Art Bell. I just love it. And I love the topic tonight. Dean Radin, Dr. Dean Radin is my guest. We're talking about consciousness. And I guess we're also really talking about intent. And I've got a question about intent in a moment. And also the fact that science is apparently not so happy, or some of science is not so happy about the work that Dean is doing and the work going on at Princeton. It is very controversial. And I suppose that in a way, as he mentioned, it kind of approaches religion. At any rate, we'll ask more about that. We'll also take calls at the top of the hour, all coming up in a moment. On this program over the years, I've asked many doctors and many scientists if they believe in God or not. And I suppose I could ask Dean the same question. I think, though, the answer I'd get from Dean would not be such an affirmative, long pause and then no. Dean, why not? Let me give it a try.
No, I wouldn't say no. I would say I'm agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
That, one of the things that, in a sense, is required if you're going to call yourself a scientist is skepticism. And skepticism, in its true sense, simply means doubt. That you are open-minded, but you doubt until you have some reason to change the doubt into a belief. For me, the belief is based on data. I believe that some psychic effects are real because I see them often enough in the laboratory and I know the conditions under which I've seen them. But at the same token, you don't want to be so open-minded that your brains fall out.
Right.
So the scientists that I'm talking about who don't like this topic are, of course, professional skeptical societies, but I don't really regard them as true skeptics. People who specialize in debunking and
they're professional. They're professional skeptics, Dean.
Well, this is what I mean, that they're deniers and mm-hmm. debunkers as opposed to people who are actually asking the hard questions and be willing to accept it if they're true.
Right. Let's move back to mainstream science. You're saying that some of mainstream science is not all that pleased with this line of research. And I do interview a lot of people, scientists, doctors, and in general, pressed, there'll be a long pause, and they'll say, no, mm-hmm. I don't believe in God. And I guess it's that group that's not so pleased, eh?
No, I'm not sure it's that. I mean, I think someone can certainly be agnostic or an atheist and accept that there's something yet to be learned about consciousness. That doesn't necessarily have anything to do with God. I expect, for example, that if you simply traced the meaning of spirituality over time, you would find that originally it was elemental spirits, you know, and other kinds of concepts that we someday may be able to actually figure out what they are in a scientific way. The whole history of science has been taking superstitions and ideas that are considered metaphysical or occult and slowly beginning to piece together a rational framework for understanding these things.
That's right. Isn't it almost the ultimate goal of science, one would think, to either prove or disprove what most people take as a matter of faith?
I'm not sure I'd put it in that way. I would say more that the goal of science is to increase our knowledge about who and what we are and the world that we live in.
Yes, but that path inevitably leads, for example, a very good example is looking at the instant of creation.
Mm-hmm.
If we look and discern what that instant of creation really was, we probably either underscore everybody's faith or, you know, push some holes in it.
I think it would actually support people's faith, because there are some very well-trained scientists, including physicists, who are also extremely religious, and they have a very strong faith. And
mm-hmm.
their faith is bolstered by what they learn in physics, because they would marvel at the amazing complexity and order that appears in the world. So I have plenty of scientists who are colleagues and friends who are very religious, and they don't see any incompatibility between their faith and what science is learning.
Uh-huh. You mentioned in your book, I think one chapter, it says here, a link between the atomic bomb and clairvoyance.
Mm.
Explain that one.
All right. Let's see. There's this guy named Sir J.J. Thompson at Cambridge University, who, among other things, was the one who measured the electron for the first time and got the Nobel Prize for it. He hired a man named Francis Aston as an assistant. And Aston, also a physicist, had read a book in 1908 called Occult Chemistry. And that book was written by the theosophists Annie Besant and Charles Leadbeater. So these are two clairvoyants who, in their clairvoyant vision, described the structure of the atom by shrinking themselves down in their mind to to be able to literally look at an atom and draw it. And one of the things that they drew was what they called a new form of the element neon, which they called meta-neon, because it wasn't quite like what they imagined neon was supposed to be. And they said that this meta-neon had an atomic weight of 22.33. So Aston read this. Some years later, 4 years later, Aston actually discovered a substance at that atomic weight while analyzing neon gas.
Wow.
He also called it meta-neon after what the theosophists had said, and he presented it in a paper to the British Association for the Advancement of Science. Later, his discovery was called an isotope, and he then got the Nobel Prize for discovering isotopes, namely elements that could have too many electrons. It became a key discovery about atomic structure, which many years later became absolutely central in the development of the atomic bomb. If there weren't isotopes, you can't have an atomic bomb.
That's right.
So this is a case where if it wasn't for the clairvoyant description of meta-neon, Aston may not have discovered isotopes, in which case we won't have atomic bombs.
All right. Also this, and I'm really, really interested in this, toward the end of your book, you have a drawing. Joe McMonagle is a remote viewer. I've interviewed him any number of times here on the program, and we've talked many times about not just remote viewing, but remote influencing. Now, I guess right now we think of a single mind as, I don't know, not that strong an influence on anything, perhaps able to influence a non-random computer or something like that. But that's about it. Not, as you pointed out earlier, move mountains or something like that. However, there is a drawing of a mind amplification device.
Right.
Now, can you explain what such a device, do you believe it to be possible, and if so, can you explain how it might work, how it might be constructed?
Well, this is part of a long-term project on looking at the role of intention in the behavior of physical systems.
Uh-huh.
If it turns out that mind and matter are actually connected in some way, which I believe the evidence suggests it is, then inconceivably it should be able to be possible to use that to do various tasks. I mean, like a silly task would be to create a psychic garage door opener. But nevertheless, a task like that, where you have a intention operated switch. So what kind of a physical system would become the detector of this intention? And by the way, it only makes sense if it can somehow be tuned to an individual, because otherwise everybody would be opening your garage door.
That's right.
In addition, it has to be able to discriminate between a frivolous thought and a thought in which you really mean it. So it has to be some degree of intelligence in terms of the detector of the intention. So I didn't know how to build one of these, and I had the opportunity to work with Joe for about a year, in which As you may know, the way that Joe works is he doesn't want to know anything in advance, because otherwise it'll tend to bias what he says.
Right.
So I simply targeted him on future technologies that did this. A future technology, not too far in the future because I wouldn't understand it, but more like prototypes of working intention switches that I wanted him to then draw. And so he did this. I have a large file full of drawings and descriptions of technologies which are in the near-term future in which these intention switches are being made.
All right. That would require not only a discerning receiver to activate a switch, it would also require perhaps some kind of amplification device, or what we would think of as a transmitter to aid the brain in transmitting a stronger signal. Yes?
Not so much on the brain side. It's more on the receiving side. The detector itself takes advantage of quantum properties, and ways of manipulating the results of quantum events in slightly new ways.
All right, so, question. Would the receiver, Dr. Radin, be tuned to the transmitter or the human brain simply by some prior association?
At least in these prototype devices, my understanding of what Joe has written is that it would have to be trained in the same way that a voice recognition system might need to be trained.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So there is an association that's formed,
right,
much like with IBM, and then from that point forward, you would essentially be tuned, the receiver would be tuned to that particular brain.
Well, yes to the brain, but more towards the intention itself. It's not the brain so much as the mind, the mind of the intender. Yeah.
All right. Intention. Let me stick for just one moment with intention. I interview people like Dr. Evelyn Paglini. She is a witch. And when I have her on the program, Dr. Radin, she talks all the time about how the importance of intention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they make all kinds of claims that a witch can do this or a witch can do that or actually cast a spell on somebody, and that it's all wrapped around intention. And I'm sure this is something that mainstream, you know, science certainly scoffs at a lot. But it sure is in the same ballpark, if you'll pardon the expression, as what you've been talking about tonight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, intention and attention seem to be the key. That's true. When you look at the, say, Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, written over 5,000 years ago, the whole process of meditation is essentially an attention training process. And the wisdom of the yogic masters basically said that if you learn to train your attention to a certain degree, eventually you learn how to calm your mind and your body becomes calm. That's like stage one. The second stage is you begin to run into clairvoyance when you are sufficiently have a still enough mind. You run into clairvoyance. When you get further down the line, you begin not only to adjust your attention, but you begin to put a little bit of intention in it as well. And it's at that stage where you start to get claims of things like levitation and invisibility and the other so-called cities. So in the laboratory, at least, we haven't gotten to the point where we're able to see those kinds of effects. But we do ask people to apply their attention and intention, and that's where we get interesting effects in both distant healing and with random number generators.
Mm-hmm. Is there any difference between Art Bell getting several million people to concentrate on one particular outcome, weather related or whatever it might be, and a group of people praying? See, here we go again. We're beginning to get back to religion a little bit. But is there any difference between this intent work that we're doing and prayer?
There's two general categories of prayer. One is you intend for something to happen. It's you wishing. The other one is thy will be done type of prayer, in which case you're wishing for the greatest good for all without having a specific outcome in mind. And people who do distant prayer, for healing in particular, oftentimes will say that the thy will be done prayer seems to work better than I wish this to happen.
Is there any science to support that?
Not too much yet.
Okay, well, I know there's been a whole bunch of experiments done that claim that prayer with intent for somebody to heal has been shown again and again and again to honestly work compared to a random sample.
The clinical trials are actually, the jury is out, I would say. Some of the studies have worked. There are two large studies recently, one at Duke University and one at Harvard University, that did not work. There are hand-waving explanations, perhaps, as to why they didn't work, but the fact is that professional prayers were told to pray for certain people, and they did not get significantly better. In fact, in the study in Harvard, the people who were being prayed for and they were told that they were being prayed for, they did significantly worse. So
Wow. The
jury is out when it comes to praying for health. But when you come into the laboratory under much better controlled conditions, the jury is in when it comes to whether or not one person's intention can affect another person's physiology.
And the answer to that is yes.
The answer to that is yes. So we don't know yet how to get from one person intending towards another's physiology to praying for somebody else's health outcome. That's a leap we don't know how to do yet.
This is such a fascinating field. And again, you know, you made that statement about communications already being mainstream. That it's, you see, I just didn't know that. I had no idea that anybody was actually using quantum technology to attempt secure communication of any kind. And you're saying that's mainstream. I sure would love to know what's going on.
Yeah, it's big. I'm sure you can find a guest who will talk your ear off on that one.
Can you suggest somebody?
Let me work on it a little bit.
All right. I'd appreciate anything in the field. I had no idea that was going on, and certainly I don't believe it's been talked about on this program. Mm-hmm. I can imagine that it would work, but I had no idea that it was working.
Yeah, it is working.
That's something that our intelligence agencies certainly would be all over. If you can imagine communication with no key whatsoever, no possibility of interception, no possibility of decryption, that's just mind-blowing.
They are. They're the main funders of this research. Yep.
Well, of course. Wow. I learn something on this program all the time. Is it the? Do you happen to know who's doing the main funding? Is it CIA, NSA? Who's doing this?
You name it. They're all funding it.
They're all funding it, huh?
Yep.
Are we leading the world, do you happen to know, Dr. Radin, in this field, or are we playing catch-up?
I think we're probably on par, although most of the basic research is coming out of Europe on this. When it comes to where we are in terms of technology, I don't know. I'm not an expert enough in that area to know. But when you look in journals like Science and Nature and Physical Review and the other main journals, a lot of the basic research is coming out of Europe on quantum technologies.
Worrisome, actually. When you look at other areas of science, the United States, because of our, you know, we're a Christian nation. There's no doubt about it. And, for example, in genetic research, we've drawn a lot of lines in the sand that we're not allowing people to pass. In Europe, they're readily going across those lines.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it doesn't necessarily hit this field, but it's hitting other fields of science, and Europe is going nuts.
And it is definitely hitting the field that I'm in as well.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. In the United States today, there is not a single active academic lab left, not one. So the Princeton lab is basically in retirement now. There are no other laboratories that are devoted to this topic in the United States within academia. There are a handful of professors who are interested and in a few cases teaching courses, but that's quite different than a laboratory. The whole thing is in Europe now.
God. All right, hold on. We're at the top of the hour. Dr. Dean Radin is my guest, and you are now welcome to line up on the lines because we're going to open the lines and allow you to ask Dr. Radin questions. My God, if you don't have questions after hearing all of this, you just have not been listening. From the high rise located in Southeast Asia, specifically Manila, Philippines, I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Take my hand, come and feel the reaper. We'll be able to.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the wildcard line at 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is 818-501-4721. To talk toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling their in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 1-800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM. Now, from Manila, Philippines, here is Art Bell.
Worldwide, indeed. Good evening, good morning, good afternoon, whatever it may be. It certainly is my honor and privilege to be escorting you through the weekend, and what a great weekend this has been. Kind of a nice welcome back. Dr. Dean Radin is my guest, and it just simply does not get any more fascinating than this. There's no question about it. My God, this is fascinating stuff. Entangled Minds is the doctor's new book, and I heartily suggest that you make your way to Amazon one way or the other and collect it for yourself quickly, because I have a feeling this is our future, one way or the other. So in a moment, we're going to open the phone lines, and it's all you and Dr. Dean Radin. I'm Art Bell. Once again, Dr. Dean Radin. I'm Art Bell. Hi there. Just before we begin on the lines here, I would like to say to you that, look, even though I'm not presently doing these experiments, if you decide that you would like to try some kind of controlled experiment, I am at your disposal.
Okay. That's a very generous offer, and I will keep it in mind.
Please do. I guess you're kind of cautious the way I am with regard to these experiments. You sound every bit as cautious as I am, if not more so. Is that so?
I have a healthy respect for what we're dealing with, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's go to the phones and see what people have to say. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Dr. Dean Radin and Art Bell. Hi.
Hey, greetings from Las Vegas, Nevada, Art. It's BD from LV. Hey, you know, as far as Dean goes, man, it's like, from what he's saying, you know, with this project, 51 hits, it seems like that we're transmitting something from our brains, which may potentially lead us to believe that the mind-brain system can act as a transmitter-receiver of particular waveforms and affect these random number generators. And, you know, it goes back to the pineal gland, the Hindus, and, you know, the pineal gland started producing DMT at 48 days. 48 days, 3,000 years ago, stated that that's when the reincarnation started taking place. And, you know, we're starting to verify all these things here in the 90s. I mean, are we getting to a tipping point, I guess, is my question.
Okay, a tipping point. Are we at some kind of tipping point, Dean?
A tipping point.
Yeah, I know. I didn't quite grasp that fully myself. But,
yeah.
You know, some kind of turning point where we're, I guess that's almost fair to say. I mean, with what you've, for example, I note that it's been some time since you and I talked. And the first time we talked and the second time, Dean, you were very, very tentative about a lot of this. This time, I listened to you carefully, and you're not as tentative as you were.
Well, we have a lot more data.
Yeah.
I mean, it basically all comes down to what is the data trying to tell us, and the data has continued to compound in such a way that the possibility that it's a mistake or chance is becoming vanishingly small. So something
300,000 to 1, that's vanishingly small, all
yeah,
right.
It'll still fluctuate here and there. You know, it'll go up and down a little bit, but it's pretty much continually been going in the direction where at some point we have to entertain some other hypothesis. Let's put it that way. Something else is going on.
Okay. Let's move east of the Rockies. You're on the air with Dr. Dean Radin and Art Bell. Hi.
Hello. This is Jacob from Chanute, Kansas.
Yes.
How you doing, Art?
Just fine, Jacob.
Mm-hmm. Pleasure to speak with you guys. My question is, in National Geographic, they had an article about the Mayan 2012 calendar and how they speak on the change of our consciousness in that turn, because we're coming to a 25,000 and 5,000 year celestial events.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you've studied or looked into any of that.
I've read a book or two, but I'm certainly not an expert in that area. The only thing which actually is relevant to the work that I've studied is the possibility that there is something peculiar about the galactic center in relationship to psychic ability. And that was actually a major surprise, even to the person who discovered it. And the discovery basically says that when it has to do with the local sidereal time and psi performance in laboratory tests.
Okay, well, what about this? The Mayan calendar, of course, ends in 2012. And on this program and any other program like it, we get endless references to 2012. So there is an expectation out there, Dr. Radin, that something's going to happen in 2012. If you look at this whole consciousness thing, that may turn into some intent that'll cause something to happen in 2012. Any worry about that?
There's always some worry that there's a self-fulfilling prophecy that goes on.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, think about all of the concern about Y2K. And Y2K came and went without a hitch.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was a lot of work in the computer business to make sure that it wasn't going to be a problem, but in this particular case, I wouldn't be too surprised if 2012, December 21st, is it, if it comes and goes without a hitch also.
Turns out to be another Y2K.
Right.
We can hope that. A lot of people do not realize the billions of dollars that were spent. They went and said, oh, what a total non-event. Well, one of the reasons it was a non-event was a lot of people did a whole lot of work and spent a whole lot of money to make it so.
That's right.
For
2012, there's nothing that we can do to prevent the alignment that is predicted to take place, in which case maybe it won't be like Y2K.
Cross fingers. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Dean Radin and Art Bell. Hi.
Hi, this is John in Seattle.
Hi, John.
When Mr. Radin was on back in May 4th, it was my first knowing that there were these random generator eggs.
Right.
And I had in the back of my head kind of a desire to see if I could affect these generators.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, really sparked an experience in my head. About 3 days, I'm guessing, after he was on, probably about 1 a.m., plus or minus, I'd been to the bathroom after break, and I came back to my table where I take notes. And instead of sitting down, I just turned and put one hand on the table. And it's like my consciousness turned a little bit, and I found myself like standing in the head of a giant entity. And the earth came out of his chest, and the word one flowed from his mouth across the earth.
Well, that's quite an experience. I have no idea what it means in the larger scheme of things, but it's an interesting experience. There is, I suppose, one thing somebody could do. Dr. Radin, it's possible to go to Google. I guess you could tell everybody how to go see the eggs, but if you go and you put in Princeton space eggs, it'll get you there. You'll eventually see them. Would it be possible, are the eggs now marked geographically? Do we know where each one is?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Are they actually marked on the screen display that you get?
Not on the screen display I think you're talking about is an overall display of behavior around the world. But there
right.
is a map that you can see where they're coming from.
All right.
If you go a little bit deeper into it.
Okay. I guess what I'm asking is, could you go to the egg that is most regional for you and sit there and have a little fun and try to affect that particular egg?
No. No, you can't get feedback like that in real time.
All right. I just thought I'd ask. There is, of course, that computer program we've referenced previously on this program that I have that I absolutely love, the one in which you can bring down a picture of the Earth, for example, and then random noise on the other side and try to get either the random noise or the Earth to materialize. And I wish there was a way to get that distributed to more people. Is there, by the way? Is that still available? Do you know?
I don't think it's still available. I can give a plug to a company that just came out with a new experiment. It's called Psygenics. I'm not affiliated with these folks at all, but it's an interesting site. It's Psygenics, Psygenics.com. And it actually is a random number generator that runs in software. And the fellow who developed it has a patent for this process. It's an interesting patent. So he's created what amounts to a similar experiment like you'd find at the Pear Lab, but you can download it and run it on your PC.
Uh-huh. How cool is that? All right, I'll be on that as soon as I'm done here. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Dean Radin and Art Bell. Hi.
Yes, hello. How are you gentlemen doing?
Quite well, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a theory to add to the discussion of mass conscious, and
sure.
If it is in fact an energy like we think of other energies, you were talking earlier a bit on the localization of these random generators, and if they in fact, or after, if in fact the phenomenon that is going on is that. But you guys pretty much have stated it, but I believe this energy, this mass conscious energy, undergoes an inverse square law, like how light energy is more prominent at its source and it spreads out and dissipates at greater distances. And
I don't think that's true. Doctor, you know, in a traditional transmitter, like a AM or an FM transmitter, what that caller said is certainly true. It's very, very strong at the source and then spreads out and becomes measurably weaker as it covers more geography. That does not seem to be true, or does it?
Well, it's an interesting question because there is some evidence that these effects drop off with distance. And I actually discussed that evidence in Entangled Minds because while it is very clear that something like remote viewing can work over distance of the planet, radio can work across the distance of the planet as well. You know, there are ways of getting signals in very far distances, and the fact is that we really haven't tested the non-locality beyond from about here to halfway to the moon, which is about as far as we've gone when Edgar Mitchell did a test from them coming back from the moon.
Correct.
So there's a couple of experiments looking at distance, and while it's not exactly inverse square, there does appear to be a decline.
Huh. Okay, well, that would suggest, if true, that it is kind of like RF in a sense, that it does dissipate with distance, and that would also, I don't know, it seems to me, it would suggest to me that it is using a specific medium in which to communicate. This is a surprise. What you're saying right now is a gigantic surprise to me. I didn't expect that. I thought that across time and distance, there was no discernible lessening of this. I'm going to call it a signal. I don't know if that's right or wrong, but whatever.
It is also true that, at least within the experiments on precognition, that there is a fall off in accuracy with increased time. So both in time and space, the assumption for a long time was that this is completely non-local and that it is the same everywhere. But in looking, I've sifted through the data pretty significantly to see if I could find evidence that for that or against it. And to my surprise, too, I found that there actually is some reason to believe that it does drop off. Which is great because it means that there's a way to get a handle on what's happening physically.
That's exactly where I was going to be going. In other words, some way to measure its frequency or the medium through which this communication is occurring. Ultimately, it would say that, wouldn't it?
That's right. It may be, however, that in the case of precognition, that the reason for a drop-off is because of the branching probabilities that occur. From, you know, like from one second from now, the world is very likely to be the same. 10 seconds from now, if you try to predict it, it's going to be a little bit different. 2 hours from now, it's going to be extremely different. And the reason for these differences is because at each stage, if you imagine every atom could go in any different direction,
there are various possibilities.
That's right. And so the future simply becomes a much more probabilistic mush as the further out you go. And by the same token, the reason for the inverse square law is basically the geometry. It's a geometric issue. If you imagine a signal spreading out like a sphere, the signal is dropping off because the surface of the sphere keeps getting bigger and bigger. And so there may be something like that, maybe a geometric way of thinking about how these things work.
Well, as you throw a rock into the water, you get a ripple. And that ripple, of course, as it approaches the shore, if it's a pretty good distance, begins to dissipate. Same idea?
Yeah, and also the height of the ripple. The height of the ripple is the largest where the rock went in.
That's right.
And then the amplitude of the ripple will dissipate because of friction and inertia and things of that sort. That one is somewhat less less to do with the geometry of the situation and more to do with physical forces that impede it. I don't think there's something like that that's happening here, but it's more that there may be a geometrical reason why these effects drop off.
All right. Wildcard Line, you are on the air with Dr. Dean Radin and Art Bell. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon in your time zone.
Good afternoon.
Yes. Mr. Radin, I was wondering if you really knew about the experiments in the Soviet Union where they used a electrocephalogram, which is basically a medical device to read microvolts off the human mind, which doctors use,
mm-hmm.
like an oscilloscope for the mind. And what they did is they put on a female adult and put her in one location, and thousands of miles away they put her child in another location. They induced pain into that children by a little pinprick, and the mother registered on the scope as feeling the pain of the child. Now this is thousands of miles in distance where they conducted this test,
mm-hmm.
and what was really weird about the test is not only that she read the pain, she felt the pain in her mind of the child being influenced with pain, but was the speed and what was registered was faster than the speed of light. So the mind is actually transferring and receiving information quicker than the speed of light, which really is quite curious to me because Einstein's theory sort of blows that out of the water,
mm-hmm.
if that's true. But we're all somehow connected. They did this with animals, too, as well. They took a small newborn of one animal. I think it was a rabbit, I believe. And they separated it to an animal. And, again, the mother that produced that offspring registered on the EEG as feeling inducing the pain.
Mm-hmm.
It's been experienced. So with that in mind, I mean, your machines could be picking up not only humans, but maybe a economic disaster in an ocean where maybe animals are dying in mass numbers. We have mass extinctions happening on this planet in certain areas, and you'd be picking up those vibes too as well if we have a mass killing of some species due to environmental catastrophes and stuff. So.
I suppose it could be, Doctor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a maybe 20 studies looking at these EEG types of experiments where two people are monitored and you do some sort of stimulus on one and measure what's happening at the other. And most of these mm-hmm. experiments have worked. It's true.
Exactly. And what about his reference to the fact that it's, I'm not sure that they've actually measured it, but is it in fact faster than the speed of light?
Well, I think what he's referring to is that sometimes the signal is seen in the receiver's brain or in their body before it actually occurs for the sender.
That certainly would be faster than the speed of light.
That would require some sort of superluminal signaling. And by the way, at this physics conference that I was at the University of San Diego, for forever, basically, physicists have said that it's impossible to do superluminal signaling because of something called Eberhard's theorem. It's a theorem which says you can't do this.
Right.
And yet a physicist there made a presentation saying he thinks there may be a way to get around Eberhard's theorem and actually get a superluminal signal that goes backwards in time by 50 microseconds. And that blew us away because this is a mainstream physicist making a prediction that could be tested.
Oh, my God. All right. Dr. Dean Radin is my guest. I'm Art Bell from Manila in the Philippines. This has been, is one fascinating program. Whether it's 1 millisecond or 50 milliseconds, if it's sent, good Lord, if it's actually sent before the occurrence, then everything with everything we know or we thought we knew about the laws of the universe in which we live is absolutely incorrect. We'll be back.
The first-time caller line is 818-501-4721. To talk toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling their in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 1-800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM. Now, from Manila, Philippines, here is Art Bell.
I suppose even the white bird alone in her cage is expressing intent, right? The intent to be free, to fly or die. That's certainly intent. I don't know that a bird has the same form of consciousness that we do, but I've long suspected it to be possible. My guest is Dr. Dean Radin. We're talking about the experiments that have gone on at Princeton. We're talking about his work. And, of course, he's got a book, and I heartily suggest that you buy it. It's called The Conscious Universe. You can go to Amazon.com, probably your ultimate destination, and get it. Again, called The Conscious Universe, something you want to investigate right away. Dean Radin will be back in a moment. Once again, Dr. Dean Radin. Dr. Radin, mm-hmm. I'm going to ask this. I think I know the answer, but I'm going to ask on behalf of Adam in Alabama anyway. He asks a question for Dr. Radin. Does he know of any schools actively working on these topics that, well, might perhaps be looking for some grad students? Thank you.
Well, there are two universities, Gary Schwartz, of course, at the University of Arizona in Tucson, has a small program on mediumship research, and Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville has a program on survival research, including things like reincarnation and near-death experience. But that's it as far as I know.
Well, that's sad.
Well, there are other locations like the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology and the Saybrook Institute, both of which are in Northern California. But if someone's looking to be a graduate student and essentially become an apprentice and have mentors that can show them how to do things in the laboratory, there is no place, not in the United States.
How is that?
In England and Scotland, there are a half a dozen universities with multiple faculty and multiple graduate students. I'm talking about the University of Edinburgh in particular and also the University of Northampton in England.
So then even as an inquiring student, you might have to end up going to Europe is the answer.
Most students who are interested in this do end up in Europe, yes.
All right. On the international line, you're on the air with Dr. Dean Radin and Art Bell. Good morning or whatever.
Morning, Art. Morning, Dr. Radin. I did some experiments way back when for downhole tools, you know, for oil wells, and we used neutron detectors and gamma ray detectors. And it was a prototype, and I was the only one that could make it work. We were just measuring a measurement of the difference between chlorine and hydrogen using, you know, a neutron source. Every time I walked up to it, it would work. Others, it didn't work. You know, everybody else was just, you know, tearing their hair out because, you know, the thing wouldn't work.
It's like the opposite of Murphy's Law.
No. When you stick things downhole, you're sticking it in Murphy's mother's kitchen oven. So, and
hey, listen, listen, how about this? How about cold fusion? Now, there's an interesting example. I think Pollard and Flashman, they ended up going to Europe, but a number of universities tried to get cold fusion to work, and in some cases they did get it to work, but in many other cases they didn't. And one almost has to wonder if intent didn't have something to do with the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, with the tools that we were working with, you know, we were just basically detecting different speeds of neutrons and ratios of them.
Right.
But for some reason, if somebody else tried to run this tool, it wouldn't work, and as soon as I walked up to it and said, you know, hey, what's wrong, little baby? And bang, you know, it would work. And I had PhDs tearing their hair out.
Are you good with other machines as well?
Yeah, I'm good with electronics and the rest. Sometimes it seems like at times I can make things work, you know, just by kind of, you know, what's wrong? Oh, okay. And then all of a sudden, bang, it works, and everybody else just kind of, they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Doing a stint fixing TVs way back when in my apprenticeship, I had guys that say, well, what's wrong with this TV? And he wouldn't know, and I'd kind of just walk by to go outside and have a smoke, and I'd just kind of, oh, look at this. And about half an hour later, he'd be cursing and swearing because that was exactly the problem.
Okay.
Yeah.
The moment he said that, the cold fusion thing popped into my mind, Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
They really had a problem with that. The people, it seems, that really wanted it to work got results. The people who were in doubt or very skeptical all bombed out.
Mm-hmm. Well, if the research on mind-matter interaction effects is true, and I believe it is true, it suggests that intention plays a role in any experiment, every experiment. So in the case of having machines work and not work, there's this famous anecdote about Wolfgang Pauli, the famous quantum physicist, who was known as being one of the top theorists in the world, but he had a reputation that whenever he came near a laboratory, no experiment would work. Things would break.
Uh-huh.
And so there's both people who have the equivalent of a green thumb and people have the equivalent of a black thumb when it comes to equipment. And in this case, the caller apparently had a green thumb.
Uh-huh. No, that's so true. It really is true, something we don't understand, but your field may impart an understanding in all of this soon enough. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Dean Radin and Art Bell. Good morning.
Hi, guys. David from Washington, D.C.,
Yes, David.
I've got a couple questions, but the throwaway is the attenuation effect makes me wonder the relationship to dark matter. But my real question has to do with your comment last night, Art, about our being a warrior species.
Mm-hmm.
And the comment that Dr. Paglini made one time about witches fighting it out on Lammas Night during World War II.
Yes.
So my question for Dr. Radin is, what happens when you have two groups that are diametrically opposed in their intention and they clash?
Well, you have the Mideast. I don't know. Dr. Radin, any comments?
Well, if we were able to visualize the intention itself, I imagine it might look like something like waves or a distortion in the medium in which we live or something of that sort, like a disturbance in the force from Star Wars. Ideally, they would cancel each other out. And so nothing would happen. But in the less than ideal case, they might interfere in a constructive way and create havoc. It would not be a pretty sight.
Yeah, it wouldn't. Well, what's bothered me about this, Doctor, is that those in the world, for example, who really wish us ill and would plow airplanes into buildings or be willing to kill themselves, to take some of us out or whatever, have an extremely strong intent.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we're just sort of whistling in the wind here, going along hoping for no terrorism and, or no trouble. But the intent on the part of somebody who's willing to give their life for their cause is going to be, strength-wise, much stronger than ours.
That's probably correct. And the reaction to that is, I think as someone said in the beginning of the Second World War, that once you awaken the sleeping tiger, mm-hmm. you're in trouble. So
that's
in other
right.
words, and if the intention of the United States is aroused and we become coherent, that's a massively powerful force.
That's correct. Unfortunately, the history of the United States becoming a tiger is not until we've been attacked. And, of course, for example, Pearl Harbor being attacked was awful. It was horrible. But it wasn't the end of the world. Now we're beginning to get hold of these weapons that, when used, could conceivably be the end of the world. So
right.
by the time we make it to a dangerous point, that by the time we're actually attacked, it's too late.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope not.
Yeah, I hope not, too. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Dean Radin and Art Bell. Hi.
Hi. I had one question about, does Dr. Radin believe that, the prophet's predictions of, say, the Bible or the Quran or any other religious text, would that have anything to do with the events that are happening now? And I think you just kind of covered that a little bit. But, the prophet's predictions coming true because of people wanting the end of the world, because of, you know, mm-hmm. say the promise, the prophecy of a promised land, or, you know, after the end of time, so to speak, they would, you know, be promised, you know, virgins or whatever. You know, I don't know what I'm trying to say there, but say enough people jumping into one religion or that influence, would that influence the sea of consciousness, so to speak?
No, I think it's a very good question. I think I know what you're talking about, and I think the doctor does too. Doctor?
Yeah. The issue about very long-term precognition is a tricky one because, as I mentioned before, that the from now until later, wherever, however long later is, there's so many possible paths to get from here to there that it becomes very difficult to predict beyond a matter of a couple of days. On the other hand, if there is something like a certain current of history that has a certain extremely strong endpoint to it, that it's conceivable that somebody might be able to predict, even thousands of years ahead, something that has this very, very strong attractor at the end. In which case, you can make a plausibility case for why some prophets may have predictions of some important endpoint, but they may not actually get the interpretation of it right. In other words, they get that something very important is coming, but they don't know exactly what it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. Remote viewers like Joe McMonagle, are they using the same, for lack of a better word, ether, the same mode of transmission that that's ultimately received by the eggs?
We don't know enough to be able to answer that question.
It almost seems that way because they, of course, remote viewers claim that they can look and discern answers and things without respect to time, past, present, or future.
Yeah. The whole point of the book Entangled Minds is addressing the issue of what sort of medium is necessary in order to have remote viewing and mind-matter interaction and precognition and all of the other phenomena. What is necessary? And the conclusion of the book is basically that a classical sense, a classical universe, doesn't do it. You can't have any kind of psychic phenomena if you're dealing with a fixed space and fixed time, or absolute space and absolute time, a Newtonian type of world. You need a different kind of underlying world in order to support these phenomena. And the world that looks like it's compatible with psi is the holistic environment that quantum mechanics suggests and some experiments now begin to show. So in a holistic medium, the one way of thinking of it is that as though we live in this gigantic bowl of jello in which everything actually is all connected, like the old concept of an ether, in a sense.
Sure.
If a disturbance actually occurs in the ether, it ripples out. It'll ripple through the whole thing, and everything is affected. So the only difference here is that intention becomes a ripple, and it affects the entire universe. And vice versa, the entire universe is also affecting you back. So that's the kind of model that is both compatible with physics as we know it and becomes compatible with these kinds of consciousness phenomena.
If only we had the eggs working back prior to World War II and Hitler, and we could have looked at all of that, if only. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Dean Radin and Art Bell. Hi.
Hi, how are you? My name's Matthew, and first of all, before I get to my question with Dr. Radin, I want to speak for just 1 second to all the aspiring graduate students out there. Ladies and gentlemen, I feel your pain, but there are more graduate programs out there than you think. You just have to get creative in finding a, quote, and I hope you'll forgive me, mainstream, more common, graduate program and getting them to fund your fancy ideas. So, for example, I'm driving across the country on my way to medical school, and I'm going to start an MD-PhD program in neuroscience, and I picked a school that has a very good neuroimaging program. Now, I'm probably going to do my PhD work and get my training in interventional radiology, really trying to increase the resolution of, how we can resolve, signals in the brain. But I've been working towards the things that you've been talking about, Dr. Radin, since, for better or for worse, since I was probably 14 or 15 years old and I really started thinking about this stuff. But there really are ways out there where you don't have to just beg DARPA for funding, which is what I did for the last couple of years before I managed to get into a different program. Which brings me to my question for Dr. Radin. So I've already touched on it a little bit. If we're going to figure out how consciousness is affecting anything, or if there is a way that consciousness is affecting things on a larger scale, I feel like we need a better idea of what consciousness is. Mm-hmm. And in order to kind of quantify how, a thought or an intention, so to speak, can actually affect something in any level, and how we can, if we've got some kind of random generating quantum device that we can, statistically study and say, something is definitely happening. Well, how can we demonstrate that impulse on an individual personal level? I want to work on that stuff. And I'm hoping that you can offer me some insight as I move forward and start thinking about the things I want to study in the next, 10, 15 years, on where you think the actual affect might be, or if you have any, insights to that.
These are all very good questions, and actually I completely agree with your strategy. Get mainstream degrees in mainstream topics and tune your dissertation or thesis work towards this area. Because while there are a lot of scientists who don't want to deal with this area, in graduate school there's a lot more flexibility on what you can actually study. And more scientists are becoming open to the possibility that there's really something interesting going on here. So that is a very good strategy. In terms of what to study, there are now about a half a dozen studies looking at functional MRI to localize in the brain through the oxygenated blood where these effects are actually occurring. I talk about some of them in Entangled Minds, and there are other documents, other articles you can find.
How much luck are we having with that? What are we seeing in the brain? Are we beginning to center on the areas that are being affected?
Yes. For presentiment effects, these are unconscious prediction effects. If the upcoming target is an emotional target, then the amygdala of the brain lights up, and you can see it in the fMRI. If you have an experiment where you have two people isolated and you stimulate one with a light flash, the occipital lobe of the receiver lights up. This is extremely important to know because it gives us a clue as to what is happening on the receiving side of these forms of signals. I put signals in quotes because we're not really dealing with signals, but by looking in the brain and looking in brain functioning on the receiving side, we can begin to piece apart what is actually happening. And this is all new within the past 5 years.
Doctor, this is so fascinating. We could go on and do show after show after show on it, and I'm sure we will, and I'm sure we'll have you back. It's been a wonderful night. Your book, The Conscious Universe, as well as Entangled Minds is the latest, right?
Right.
It's the one they should all be looking for at Amazon.com or whatever. We're going to have you back. As I mentioned earlier, you were kind of tentative in the earlier interviews, but tonight you've been a lot more specific, so obviously a lot has occurred in this field. Even with the limited amount of study that apparently has been going on, particularly in this country, there is a lot that's new. It's so exciting. I just cannot imagine that more, obviously people are attracted to it, but there's not more money pouring into it, and I guess if somebody's really interested, they can. Is there a way to contact you?
The easy way is dean@noetic.org.
dean@noetic.org.
Right.
Is that right?
That's right.
So if somebody's got some money they want to pour into this, no harm in asking.
Send me an email.
Send you an email. And you're obviously out front on all this. So, Dr. Radin, thank you for being on the program. Thank you for being such a light in the night.
Thank you so much.
Good night, my friend. All right, there is Dr. Dean Radin. And as you all know, this is certainly one of my favorite